All right, so one other thing before we get started, I want to give a couple of books if you want to read. The best book, the one that's really going to be a lot of our guideline, is a book called More Than Conquerors by a man named William Hendrickson, who died back in 1982, I think it was, 1981, 1982. That's an excellent book on the Book of Revelation. I like his little subtitle is An Interpretation of the Book of Revelation. It's not the interpretation. It's not the final word. It is an interpretation of the Book of Revelation. It's a fairly simple read, I think, but if you want an even simpler read, which covers the book from a largely parallel understanding of it, is Richard Brooks' The Lamb Is All the Glory. This is by Evangelical Press, a part of their Wellen series. Wellen is spelled W-E-L-W-Y-N, but it's pronounced not Wellwyn, it's Wellen. And this series of commentaries, it's worth getting all of these books, I think. I have not actually read every single one. Every one that I have read, and I have read a number of them all the way through. I've read them in pastoral studies. I've read them in family worship. We've read my wife and I read this years ago together in our four kids and family devotions. More Than Conquerors is available on Kindle. It may be actually the cheapest way to get it. Some people are selling More Than Conquerors for $50 or something on Amazon because I don't think it's currently in print. You can probably get it for $5 or $6 if you go to Amazon, but just be warned. If you see the first thing comes up, it says $50. Just do a little more search. The Kindle version is $9, $10, $11, something like that. All right, so a few of those introductory words behind us. So we are going to begin tonight to examine the book of Revelation as best we can in 12 or 13 weeks that we have over the summer. There are generally, as I understand it, two basic reactions to the book of Revelation. One is to view it like it is the most important book of the Bible. It's the most exciting, it's the most thrilling, it's the most relevant book of the Bible. It's the most important book if you want to understand the times in which we live, if you want to be prepared for the end. And I simply want to say that it's not, and there is no one book that we can say that about. It is a part of the Word of God. It is one of 66 books given for our edification. And honestly, though, I mean, the reason some of you are here is not because I don't think you're here because, well, which one is Jim teaching? You're here because this class is on the book of Revelation. And if I said, hey, we're going to do, Nahum and Obadiah for 12 weeks, some of you might have decided to go to the marriage class or some of you may have decided to go to the Proverbs class. The book of Revelation has a level of intrigue to it and interest in it. And then I'm going to bring that up with the second response sometimes. So one is to act like it's the most important book in the Bible. The other is to ignore it. And we ignore it perhaps because we don't understand it. And we're maybe a little bit afraid of it because the people that tend to concentrate on the book of Revelation tend to be guys like John Hagee on the television. And it tends to come with all these charts and everybody predicting exactly, this is the Balkans War and this is the part about World War II and this is the part about Cobra helicopters and, this is the part about Vietnam. And you say to yourself, I can't figure, I never saw Russia in that or I never saw. And so you kind of, but it seems like that's the only interpretation available, kind of the left behind. And you kind of get the sense, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's a right interpretation. And so because we don't know what a right interpretation of it is, we sometimes tend to ignore it. And so I don't think we should ignore it. It is one of those books that is given to us for our edification. It's one of the books that is certainly given to us as the people of God for us to grow. And it is a book that is given to us so that Jesus Christ might be honored and glorified, that the way of salvation might be made known, that the way of holiness might be promoted. And so in that sense, it is like all the other books that God has given. It's profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness. All right, so now what I want to do tonight is I just want to kind of give a few basics. And I have a lot of material. I'm hopeful I'm going to get through all of it. I might not get through all of it. But I'm going to have a lot of things. And so if you need me to stop, then so put your hand up, wave it around a little bit, and I'll try to answer. But so this is going to be a little bit of buckle up for this first little bit in the book. And then we're going to, Lord willing, relax a bit more and try to, even though we're going to take large chunks, we'll be more interactive as the time goes. All right, so let's consider a general introduction, and whenever you're studying a book of the Bible in any kind of a technical sense, you ask yourself some of the basic questions. Who wrote it? Where did they write it? Under what circumstances did they write it? What was the crisis that they were addressing, or the problem, or the issues they were addressing, and who was it written to? Those are some of the things, and we'll consider some of those. The first thing is, who wrote the book? All right, so what do we all understand? Who wrote the book? John. All right, so John wrote the book. Now, you may be interested to know that there is a question among commentators and exegetes about which John. And there, if you read the book of John, and particularly if you were able to read it in the original, and you're able to compare it to the Greek of Revelation, the gospel writing is a far higher form of Greek. Just again a higher level. The book of Revelation is more rudimentary in its Greek. It's obviously stylistically very, very different. How John communicates, whoever this John is, you say at first, is very different than how John communicates in the Gospel of John and in the epistles that are given to the disciple whom Jesus loved. With all of that being said, and again, in a class like this, I'm not going to get into all the arguments for and against. The internal evidence and then also the early church evidence points very clearly that this John who is spoken of is the John who wrote the Gospels, and we're going to take it from that vantage point. Now, he identifies himself as John. In fact, he does that four times in the book. He does it in chapter 1 and verse 1. He does it again in verse 4 of chapter 1, in 21 and verse 2, and in 22 and verse 8. He specifically identifies himself. Now, he doesn't do that. Remember, he never calls himself John in John. He doesn't use his name. He doesn't use his name in John, and he doesn't use his name in the epistles, and that's one of the reasons some people think this is a different John. I think one of the reasons we can be encouraged, besides the early church evidence, is that John is able simply to call himself John and say to the early church, this is John, without any other explanation, John the guy who's this, John the guy who's that. He's simply John, and everybody knew who John was. So that, you know, Peter can say Peter, John can say John, and everybody has a basic understanding of who he was. All right, so secondly, a word about when the book was written. Now here, the arguments are a little bit more complex and difficult. You're going to find weighty arguments on one side and the other. So there is an argument for an early reading of John. Writing of Revelation, a prior to 70 AD. And does anybody know who's the emperor around this time? Roman emperor, really bad dude, one of the most famous emperors. Nero. All right, so this is during the time of Nero. And there are certainly some things in the book of Revelation that seem to point rather pointedly to Nero. Now, I'm going to argue Nero doesn't necessarily have to be alive in order for that to be the case. He casts a very long shadow over the land and in regard to persecution, and particularly in regard to emperor worship. And there are references in the book of Revelation to emperor worship that was going on at that time. And most people date the book somewhere between 90 and 95. Anybody know who the emperor was then? Domitian, right. And, you know, these were during times of of persecution, or at least the beginning of persecution. You're going to see that theme woven through throughout the book. We're going to have references to martyrs under the altar. You're going to have references to several of the churches, some of the seven churches in Asia Minor, where Jesus addresses them in regard to their persecution. Some of the evidence, again, for the early has to do with things like Nero. And if you do the numerical equivalent of Nero's name, just going to give this freebie away, it comes out neatly as... so that he's 666. So some people say, well, it seems obvious. There's also a reference, and it's in chapter 11. John is told to measure the temple. And the temple by this time has been what? It's been demolished. It's been destroyed. It was destroyed in 70. And do you know who the great general that oversaw the destruction of? His name's Titus. That's right. So obviously not our Bibles, not that Bible Titus, but Titus. And so when you hear throughout, well, we're going to make references to Titus. Anybody know how long the siege of Jerusalem lasted? 3.5 years. Times half the time. Some of the 3.5. Some people think the 3.5 years, a great tribulation is spoken of, has some reference there. So there are some things that make some of that weighty. However, most commentators do fall in with the latter date, somewhere 90 to 95 during the reign of the emperor Domitian. There are certain, again, aspects of what John writes that fit perhaps, you know, better into one than the other. I have a lot of temptation toward that view, not in a bad way, but most of the evidence seems to fall ultimately here, and so we will go with that. Maybe occasionally I'll make some reference to why you might like an earlier date for the book of Revelation. Any questions or comments so far? That's fairly clear. All right, let's talk a little bit about the recipients. So one of the things we talk about whenever we are doing a study of the Bible is that we're reading somebody else's mail. You know, as much as you might like to say, oh, this is, I've seen people with Bible covers that say, you know, Jesus love letters to me or something like that. It's very sweet and it's nice and there's an element of truth to that. But just as when you come to study the New Testament epistles, what was happening in Corinth was different than what was happening in the churches of Galatia, was different than what was happening in Philippi, etc. And these books are written generally to address either a crisis or questions that were being raised in a particular place. So who are the recipients of John's writings? And you can read it there in chapter 1. If you have your Bible open, chapter 1. And let me go ahead and I'm going to say this several times. It is the name of the book. Unlike every Hollywood movie, there is no S. If you want to see me groan, just call it. In Revelations 5. No! Revelation 5. So anyway, I have that little bit of a pet peeve about it. But every Hollywood movie, Book of Revelations, Book of Revelations, Book of Revelations. Like, just open a Bible and read it. There's no S. So, the Revelation, who is it written to? Who's it addressed to? You see it right there in the opening verses. All right, and what else? The seven churches of Asia Minor. All right, it's written to seven churches. You need to understand that. That's its immediate audience, okay? That is specifically to whom it is addressed. Now, we're going to learn more about these, a little more about these seven churches, God willing, next time. But that simple truth, which seems, again, it is so simple, is one of the first things that we really need to understand. So what do we learn from this? That it is written to the seven churches. What are some things you can glean from the fact that it was written to these specific seven churches? What are, just a couple of things. All right, so those churches, yeah, they, you know, they're I don't know if there's any remnants of any of them left, but okay, so they're not around today. So what do you glean from that? Right, yes. All right, good. So, right, what some people will say is that the book of Revelation was essentially irrelevant to these seven churches. That it is, it's written to these seven churches, but what it's really for are these people at least 2,000 years later. Now, if Christ doesn't come back in our lifetime, and if Jesus doesn't come back for another 500 years, then that interpretation means it's not written for us either. And the idea of some people is that the book of Revelation is written to what one guy called the terminal generation. It was written for the last generation, and that it is essentially mysterious to all these people that have lived between 95 and 2019. And that John is talking about things like Israel's wars with Russia and modern warfare, and they've tried to put all this kind of meaning into it, which ignores the simple interpretive reality that these things were first written to a particular people. And I think that's one of the most important things that we need to understand this. Now, they are not the sole intended audience. These seven churches, as we are going to see, are in large part representative of churches throughout church history. In regard to the things that Jesus sees in them and the things that Jesus addresses, there are elements in them that are going to be seen throughout, again, the history of the church. But we need to understand that it was initially written to a group of people living in a particular time. And what do we know basically? What are some things we know about this time in which they live? Okay, even if it's 70, even if it's somewhere between 70 and 95, what do we know about them? All right, they're being persecuted. All right, so it's written to a persecuted people or people on the brink of even greater persecution. There is the threat of even greater persecution. So that's very, it's a very important thing for us to understand when we come to consider, like, so what's the theme of the book? What's the book all about? Well, again, to understand that, you need to take off your 2019 lenses and go back to a first century lens and to understand that this was written by, through the Holy Spirit, through John, to a group of churches that were having a lot of problems at that time, a lot of struggle and a lot of fear and a lot of confusion. So put yourself there for a minute, all right? If it were said, brethren, we maybe got, government has said 2 more weeks and we're out of here. They've already arrested Pastor Charlie. Pastor Derek is being sent back to Oklahoma. They're going to be coming to, after me and John next. And I don't know if we're going to be able to meet together or where we're going to be able to meet together. What are some of the things you might, well, take us out of it, but just what might you be feeling? Settled or unsettled? Fearful or peaceful? All right. So it's written to a people that Jesus knows are fearful and worried and concerned. And what does it look like when the church is being persecuted like this, or when you are going through, just in your own individual life, when you're going through one hardship after another, what are you tempted to believe about God and His promises? He's forgotten you. Who appears stronger when Roman soldiers burst into a church and drag them away? Who appears stronger? Yeah, the devil seems stronger, or Nero or Domitian appear to be stronger. It's as though their will is being done. And it's as though their throne, the throne in Rome, is the one calling the shots. Right? And so when you understand that, it's helpful then to try to understand exactly what the Lord is addressing. And so I want to begin then to talk just a little bit about the structure and purpose of the book. So what does this book remind us of? Well, if you had to sum up. All right, so that's one of the great themes. All right, Christ is King. The crown of Christ. All right, so there are numerous references in the Bible to thrones. Where's every throne that is mentioned in the book of Revelation? It's in heaven. And who's sitting on it? A glorious, resplendent God being worshipped. Right? Because what are you tempted to forget when you look at things? You're tempted to think that that's not true. All right, summarize it again. You can put it in largely similar words if you want. What's the theme of the book of Revelation? It's, try to give it one or two sentences, a few words. The Lamb wins. Right. All right, the Lamb wins. So who is triumphant overall? What happens to all the enemies? Where do you find the harlot and the beast and the false prophet and Satan at the end of the book of Revelation? Where are they all? They're in the lake of fire. They're all, where's Babylon? Fallen, this is Babylon, right? It's all, they're all the enemies are destroyed. Where are God's people at the end? What's the final shot? Where are we all at the end? Yeah, we're with the Lord. We're following the Lamb. We're in glory. Yeah, it's triumph. It's victory. Everybody, every enemy, every high thing exalted against Christ is destroyed. So the Lamb wins, right? I actually have that in my notes. The Lamb wins. So the book is intended to remind God's people in the midst of strife and hardship that God is on the throne, that Christ and his people will triumph. The Lamb wins, and we are, as the book says, more than conquerors. And it does not always appear this way. It doesn't always appear that the Lord is on our side and that he is using every resource available to him, which is every resource, for our good and for the good of the church. Feel that way when churches split? To feel that way when another pastor is discovered in sin? To feel that way when your kid is really sick? To feel that way when you're grossly disappointed in your circumstances in life? No, it doesn't always appear that way. It doesn't appear, does it culturally right now, does it appear we're on the winning side?
We know we are,
but it doesn't always seem that way, does it? Yeah, it doesn't seem that way at all. And, you know, I don't want to be one of these fear mongers, but the trajectory of our nation is not altogether encouraging. This is not Christ Pride Month. Google and every company is not putting crosses on their logos. It's the flag. It's the flag of homosexuality. That is being enjoyed and triumphed. I'm going to run out of time. I say everything I want to say. All right. So what things are not, it's a part of the book of Revelation is to say things are not always as they appear. This book is intended in straightforward statements and through signs and symbols to encourage the hearts of God's people. Okay. It's a peek behind the curtain. And it's a glimpse not only into the church's current situation, but also into its glorious future. Now, in doing that, we'll say again a little something now more about the structure. And we're here now, if you've got your outline, number two, purpose and structure of the book. And obviously you have no place to write on here the way I've written. I've done this, but I'm always trying to be economical and just do everything on one sheet if I can. But let's talk a little bit now about the structure of the book. And you'll see there, I've written in your notes, progressive parallelism. All right, so what's parallelism? All right, side by side, and we're talking about in the Bible, what are we usually referring to? All right, so yeah, you have the same. Did I spell that correctly? I think I did. All right. So progressive parallelism is telling essentially the same thing. So we see this a lot in the Bible, don't we? And particularly in poetry. It is one of the ways that God communicates truth, and he'll say it one way, and then he'll say it another way, and then sometimes say it another way. And it's the same thing, but it's looked at from different vantage points. But when it's progressive parallelism, what might we be saying with that? So not just telling the same story over and over again, but yeah, adding a little bit. It's not just telling the exact same story, but you get a little bit more of the story. So you're going to look at it from a different vantage point, and then suddenly as you do that, you're going to get a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more, so that by the end it reaches something of a crescendo. Now, what some commentators have argued and what I am convinced is right is that the book of Revelation is not a linear story like Luke, starting with the birth of John the Baptist and the birth of Jesus, and then going straight through to the cross and to the empty tomb. But rather, what it's doing is telling the same story seven different ways. Seven times, seven different ways. So that in chapters 1 through 3, in 1 through 3, you have here, what's the primary, I don't expect everybody to know every part of Revelation, but generally 1 through 3 is what? It's the letters to the churches. And if these churches are indeed representative, not just of their own selves, but of all churches throughout the ages, you have there a portrait of Christ being among his people. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And again, one of the encouraging things, and this is for next week though too, but Christ is with his churches. Christ is walking among his churches. And he says to them, I know, I know, I know, I know, I know. Because again, what are the people so often tempted to say about Jesus? Don't you care? Don't you know? Don't you understand? And he's always saying, I do know. I do know. I know everything about you. I know what's in your heart. I know what's good about you. I know what's bad about you. I know what you're about to face. I know what you have faced. I know what you're going to face. I am with you. In chapters 4 through 7, you have the seven seals. Now, one thing you're going to be alerted to in the book of Revelation is that 7 is a very important number. A wild guesstimate. How many times does 7 appear in the book of Revelation? A little bit more. That's a great answer, though. What did you say? A little bit more than that, yeah. That's like 50, I think it's 54 times. And so when you see 7, you know, 54 times, it all alert you that maybe that has something to do with the structure. So how many churches are there? 7. How many trumpets are there? How many bowls are there? How many seals are there? 7. All right. 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7. So it might be, and again, these are the kinds of things people have, you gotta be, you know, guys who are a lot smarter than me figure some of this stuff out. I can read something, and they said, did you notice that story was told 7 times? No. and then somebody pointed out, I was all of a sudden, it's like, oh, wow, all right, now I see it. It's like when somebody reviews, sometimes they'll review a movie, and they'll say, did you notice this symbolism and that? And I'm like, I do now. But so 4 through 7 is the book with the seven seals. Okay? Begins in heaven. Christ is then given the book. The seven seals are open. And then in chapters 8 through 11, you have there the seven trumpets of judgment. In 12 through 14, you have there the woman and the man-child persecuted by the dragon and his helpers. In 15 and 16, you have the bowls of wrath. And then in chapter 17 through 19, you have the fall of the great harlot and the beast. And then in 20 through 22, the judgment on the dragon, followed by the new heavens, the new earth, and the new Jerusalem. That's going to be the structure that we're going to consider the book from. And what you'll do, and again, I don't have the time tonight. If I had said everywhere, I want you to read the whole book of Revelation 2 or 3 times before you got here. But this is why when you're coming through, you're going to see things that point to the last judgment. So even in some of the matters with the churches, there's a pointing to the final judgment. You're pointed here. So you have these things. So here you have the people of God surrounding the throne and worshiping. And then here you have, you know, people calling for the rocks and hills to fall upon them. And then it starts all over again. And then you have in chapter 12, you have Jesus being born. And then it comes, there's judgment, and then it starts all over again. There's reference to the beginning of the church. So that what it does is it tells the story of the church age from the beginning of the ministry of Christ or the death of Christ through to the end. And what you'll find is that each of these sections deals either with Christ coming, judgment falling, or the saints being received up in glory. And when you try to consider that, you know, linearly, and say, and you think, oh, well, where's this and where's that? You know, why is everything ends and then it all ends again and then it all ends again and then a third of the things are destroyed and then later on they're destroyed again? Well, they're not destroyed again. It's just telling the same story from a different perspective. And so that's what I'm going to argue, and we'll, Lord willing, see that as we work our way through in the weeks ahead. All right. Any questions, comments? But you at least understand where I'm getting at with that, Larry. Right.
Christianity was only a small part of
the right. Yeah, and so to see even these pictures of myriads of myriads, people from every tongue, tribe, and nation, you know, surrounding the throne. Some of those things, yeah, the success, the progress of the gospel, even in the midst of persecution. People being comforted, people are being persecuted, being comforted, being told, this gospel you love is going to succeed. All right, let me just say a quick word about symbolism. And then I had 11 things I wanted to go through real quickly, and I'll say them really, really quickly, and then we want to pray. All right, so this is a book full of symbols. And you get the key to that very early on in the book that, and so this is the difference between what we might say literally and what I'm going to call letteristically. So let me explain. All right. So Jesus says, you know, so chapter 1, he gives this description of Christ, and it talks about him walking among, you know, he's given this vision of what he looks like, what his feet are like, what his eyes are like, and his hair is like, and all of this. And then he says this, verse 19, chapter 1, write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after this. The mystery of the seven stars, which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands which he saw are seven churches. So he's giving you a key. There's a symbol, and there's the meaning. So how do you take the lampstands literally? They're churches, right? The literal interpretation of lampstands is churches. The letteristic interpretation is, well, they're lampstands. It says lampstands, it's got to be lampstands. Well, no, he says these lampstands are this. So that when you see a lamb having seven eyes, do we say Jesus has seven eyes? Are there seven spirits? Well, it says that it is, so that, again, there are symbols being used. And we need to understand that. Because, so like if I said to you, it was raining cats and dogs. Well, Jim's a man of his word. And he's meant to be taken literally. So I expect in his yard are bunches of little kitties and little puppies, because he said, quote unquote, it rained cats and dogs at my house. Well, you understand what that means. No, you say it rained a lot, right? And so when we come to certain things and we say that, brethren, we need to understand that this or that is a symbol, it doesn't mean that we are being liberal. So when I taught a class the other day on some of the way of understanding the Bible's eschatology, and I argued that in the Bible there is a two-age structure, this age and the age to come, and that Jesus says repeatedly, and that Paul says repeatedly, that when Christ comes, it's the end, and that it then ushers in the new heavens and new earth. For some people, that's viewed as being liberal. They say, well, you don't take the Bible literally. Well, to take the Bible literally, you need to understand what it is trying to convey. And if it's using lampstands to talk about churches, then I am being literal when I say this symbol means that. In fact, one of the guys, Sam Baer, the week after I taught that, he was visiting a church that has such a strict view of the end times, and the guy had the charts and what was going to happen when Jesus, you know, when the rapture would take place and what would happen in the middle of the tribulation and after the tribulation and all this stuff about the millennium. And he said, you know, my pastor said that Jesus taught there was this age and the age to come, and that he said, kind of like when he comes, it appears like there's the resurrection and there's judgment. That's what it looks like. And the teacher of preacher's response was, does your pastor promote homosexuality? I was all like, but the idea was, he's obviously a liberal. To teach anything other than the view that he was holding is liberalism. And I'm just simply saying that now you may hold to a different view, but please don't call this liberalism. This is an attempt to understand from the text itself how the text structures itself. All right, so very quickly, you've got these things in front of you. I'm going to just give them to you. And so first thing I want to talk, this is a book about Jesus. Okay? It's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And it's not just the revelation that he brings, it's also the unveiling of who he is. He holds the keys. He's the very God of very God, the Alpha and the Omega. There's so much that is encouraging. He's the faithful and true. He's the one who comes and brings judgment. He is the object of Satan's ire. He's the reason we're at war. He's the reason we are being persecuted. All right. Secondly, it's a book about the church. And it's especially a book about the struggling church and the church at war with both the world and Satan. It also points out to us that Christ has better things for the church. And that's something that we're going to consider. It's a book about eternity. It gives some of the most beautiful descriptions of the eternal state, the blessings of those who Christ and the horrors of judgment. It is a book about the past, and that is, it must be understood, as I said, in terms of the people to whom it is written, it was for them. The opening chapters and the closing verses make it abundantly clear that this book was not a mystery that was sealed up for 2,000 years awaiting our knowledge to finally understand it. The symbolism was first century symbolism. The genre of apocalyptic literature was far better known to them than it is to us. And that's part of the reason why we have a hard time understanding it, is that we are not as conversant with apocalyptic literature, which was its own genre at that time. Now, there is a genre called apocalyptic literature now, but it's usually about viruses and zombies and things like that. It's also a book about the present. And this, too, must be remembered. This book is not only for those to whom it is written originally, but it brings comfort to the saints of God through all the years until this very moment. This book not only explained the world in which the first century church lived, it explains our world as well, in which there is an active enemy, in which there are things happening behind the scenes, often unknown to us and to our native eye. So actually, I meant to say it's a book about the present. If I said future, I'm sorry. I did say present. Oh, good. Good for me. All right. This is a book about the future. And though I've argued this is not the fundamental concern of the book, it does reveal to us truths concerning the end of the world and the coming of Christ in glory, the judgment upon the world, the resurrection, the lake of fire, the new heavens, and the new earth. It's a book that tells us of a time when there will be no more curse, a time when human history, which is going somewhere on God's timetable, when it all comes to an end. Seventhly, this is a book about deeper truths. And what I mean by that is going deeper than the surface. All of human history needs to be understood in terms of chapters 4 and 5. It must be understood in the light of an enthroned God and of a worthy Lamb who opens the seven seals and unveils the plan of God for all of human history. The world must be understood in terms of chapter 12 and the working out of the evil one who is enraged against the child who is born and makes war against those who have the testimony of Jesus and keep the commandments of God. Eighthly, this is a book about suffering. This is a book that speaks of the reality of suffering, the source of suffering, and the end of suffering. Ninthly, this is a book about judgment. It's about the wrath of God and the wrath of the Lamb. It's about what God will do to a world that has been long in rebellion against Him and what He will do to the enemies of the church, spiritual and material, that is, earthly rulers and the rulers in heavenly places. By heavenly places, I'm using the language of Ephesians and speaking about the enemy. It's a book about faithfulness. We could bring out the fact that it's a book about God's faithfulness, but it's also a book about Christian faithfulness. Jesus says to the church in Smyrna, be faithful until death, chapter 2 and verse 10. He says to the church, to the church in Pergamum, Jesus speaks of Antipas, his faithful martyr. In chapter 17 and verse 14, we read about those who are with the Lord, called, chosen, and faithful. It's encouragement not to give up. Eleventhly, it is a book about triumph. The headlines of our day, the headline of the day would have probably said something like, infant church in danger of being snuffed out. The message of the book of Revelation is not only does Jesus triumph, and not only is the gospel vindicated, but God's people are as well. The church is the apple of Christ's eye. It is His bride. Wherever He goes, they go. Where He is, they must be. They have suffered with Him, and now they will share His glory. And that is, I trust we will see, the book of Revelation.